All right, north side, Fulton Stadium area.
Heard shots off, way off in the distance. I figured it was coming from the direction that Doug was at. I figured he got a deer. That's what I figured I was walking back to.
After hearing those two gunshots, Bobby Brown had not immediately headed back in stepdad Doug's direction. He waited for a time, just in case Doug had missed his shot and that deer had been flushed out.
I took my time when I did go. I was walking real slow, trying to be quiet, just hoping one would come through the swamp.
It was 20, maybe 30 minutes later before Bobby made his way back to where Doug had been. There, he found his stepfather's body, face down and tangled up in some logs. And not far from him was a second body, also face down. Bobby did not recognize the second man, but scattered about him were the contents of his wallet. Bobby ran to Doug's friend Mark Perry, who was hunting in the woods nearby, and took him back to where the bodies were. And then, Bobby and Mark split up, each running for help in a separate direction.
So what happened on your way back out to the road?
I ran into that guy. Had glasses. I thought he had blonde hair.
Bobby's immediate reaction to encountering the man had been to raise his shotgun and point it directly at his head. The man had quickly tried to calm Bobby down and asked him, "Is anyone hurt?"
I told him, "No, people dead out here." He asked me to take him to him.
He's the first guy you see and he says, "Take me back to the bodies. Or just take me back there."
Show me, or, yeah.
The man had looked at the bodies that Bobby showed him, but he hadn't made any offers of assistance. That's when Bobby realized the man wasn't going to be any help, so he turned and ran to look for help from elsewhere. Bobby never saw the blonde man in glasses again. He was gone before the police arrived. No one ever got his name. That day, though, there had been hunters everywhere in the Fulton game area. It was the first Saturday of deer season, and there was so much blaze orange out that some hunters described the forest as looking like a pumpkin patch. Among the hunters out that day were a group of friends from the town of Parchment. They'd been hunting on the other side of Bear Creek, and when they heard Bobby's cries for help, they'd rushed back to their trucks and driven over to try and help. When they pulled into the parking area off of X Avenue, though, they discovered someone had beaten them there.
And me and Mark were the first ones here. There was an old ambulance. There was two gentlemen standing there. Mm-hmm. And the guy goes, "Hey, man," he goes, "you guys want to go see two dead bodies?" The man had, what I remember, was Stephen King glasses.
Stephen King and his quieter companion were gone before the police arrived. And just like the man Bobby pointed his gun at, they were never identified. But if they had been, Jeff Titus might not be in prison today. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Jeff Titus. Today is the final episode in this series. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
I didn't do it. I was 30 miles away. All I did was walk back there that day and find a gun. And I wish I'd never found that gun.
Somehow Doug Estes' shotgun had ended up at a location over 125 feet away from where he and Jim Bennett had been killed. That's where, 2 days after the murders, Jeff Titus says he found the gun lying beside a tree limb on the forest floor. For a while after that, Jeff had gone about bragging to anyone who would listen, or anyone who'd pretend to listen, about how he'd been able to find the shotgun when the police hadn't. But then, a few months after the murders, Jeff's story suddenly changed. He began to tell friends and coworkers a different explanation for how it was that he'd been able to find that shotgun.
The story I got had to do with this Big Jack business. And that made no sense. That's the reason I let them, in effect, record the conversation I had with him to try and track down some sort of meaning with that. Is all I know is the story about his finding the gun is suspect.
The Big Jack business that Stan Driscoll is referring to is Jeff's story about what his friend and coworker, Big Jack Warren, had told him a few months after the murders.
That's what Jack told me. He said that was the only reason you found that gun. He said somebody else found it. They took it home, and then when they found out about the murders, they brought it back. Now, he never told me who.
Do you think he knew who, or it was just a theory?
I think he probably did. He probably does. But he just flat out denied it. But he told me. Because it was down in the power plant on third shift.
At Jeff's trial, Big Jack testified that he'd never told Jeff anything about someone taking the gun away and later returning it. And a lot of Jeff's other coworkers at the VA ended up testifying against him too. Mostly they testified about vaguely recalled conversations they'd had with Jeff Titus more than a decade earlier. And now he'd said something or another about how he'd found the gun, taken it home, and then returned it to the game area.
They turned around and said, well, I said that. And it ain't what I said, it's what Big Jack told me. And I just repeated it.
Stan had found the Big Jack story to be strange the first time he'd heard it from Jeff. But after Stan learned from the cold case detectives that Big Jack had denied ever telling Jeff that someone else had found the gun, he'd begun to think this story was more than just strange. It was downright suspicious. In Stan's first letter to Jeff after his conviction, he described how his doubts about the Big Jack story had later grown, at least temporarily, into doubts about Jeff's innocence.
Shortly before the trial, though, my disquiet over this issue abated since I finally accepted that shotgun Big Jack story was probably a fabrication. It then became possible to conceptualize scenarios of what might be the real story behind the shotgun. Although it does not present either you or the police in a desirable light, the scenario I finally developed accords with your story to the VA people while providing an explanation of how you could have had possession of the shotgun without being the perpetrator of the crime.
Based on Stan's conclusions about the Big Jack story, Stan's advice to Jeff was for him to finally come clean, to finally admit that he'd found a gun, brought it home with him, and then realized that he'd made a huge mistake. So he put it back, pretended to find it again, and came up with the Big Jack story as a cover. Jeff rejected his friend's advice. He wrote back to Stan, "Don't believe everything someone says I said, okay? I was told by Big Jack what he said. It is not a fictitious story."
Stan was right, though. The Big Jack story is strange and suspicious. And I too found myself wondering if Jeff was lying about it. But I'd wondered as well if the Big Jack story could all just be a big misunderstanding. What if, all those years ago, Big Jack had just been offering up a theory about how Jeff Titus had been able to find the gun? After speaking to Big Jack Warren, it made a lot of sense to both Jacinda and I how a misunderstanding like that could have happened.
Did you suggest it? Well, maybe someone brought it back to the crime scene?
That's what I feel. I feel somebody took the gun and realized they made a mistake, and they brought it back and threw it down somewhere.
Big Jack's theory about what happened to the shotgun doesn't sound all that different from the Big Jack story that Jeff says he was told.
You know what Big Jack told me? He said, the only reason I found it is because somebody else in the Athens found it.
But he didn't confirm to you that he knew the person, did he?
What?
Did he say outright, I know the person, or...
Was it just a theory, Jeff?
I don't think the way he said it, that it was a theory. The way he said it was like he knew who it was, but he wasn't saying.
Athens is a little farm town just to the east of Fulton. And it's this oddly specific detail about the person who found the gun being from Athens that makes me doubt the conversation between Big Jack and Jeff could have all just been a hypothetical. But if this wasn't a hypothetical, then who is the person from Athens that Big Jack could have been referring to?
Where are you from, Athens? Do you know any connections there?
No, we're from here.
Okay. Do you know anyone from Athens? No?
No.
And if Big Jack doesn't know anyone from Athens, then he couldn't have known someone from Athens who took the gun and brought it back to the crime scene.
This isn't the only problem with the Big Jack story either. Aside from emergency responders and sheriff's deputies, there are only a limited number of people who are known to have had access to the crime scene and who could potentially have had an opportunity to take the shotgun. There's Doug's stepson Bobby Brown, of course, and Doug's friend Mark Perry. And Ron Elwell, the neighbor to the north, who Mark Perry ran to for help and who came back with Mark to the crime scene.
It was him and I for the longest time, and no, I never seen another hunter. I didn't see anything.
So y'all were alone there, and then...
We were for quite a while.
And you think it's Clarence and one of his sons?
Yeah, there was only one of them, okay. And it must have been Todd.
Yeah.
So. When it began to grow dark, and Ron still had not returned from the woods, his wife Sandy had gotten worried, and so she called her neighbors Clarence and Pat Jones to see if someone could go check on Ron. The Joneses lived on the property just behind the Elwells. They had a junkyard there off Vex Avenue. Clarence and Pat's older son, Troy, was not at home when Sandy called, but their younger son, Todd, happened to have been home from college that weekend. So it was Clarence and Todd who headed back into the woods to find Ron.
I don't remember Clarence coming clear in.
Todd says he was there very briefly, and he just peaced out.
I don't remember them coming back to where we were.
Todd Jones ended up testifying at Jeff Titus's trial. He said it was just him and his dad that went back to look for Ron, because his brother Troy hadn't been home at the time. And they'd approached the crime scene, but they hadn't gotten too close. They'd stayed a couple dozen feet away from the bodies. And Todd said he hadn't remained in the woods for long at all. Once they'd located Ron, and once Todd had gotten a glimpse of the two dead men laying there on the forest floor, he'd turned around and quickly left again. So that's a total of 5 known witnesses who were near the crime scene that night and theoretically could have taken the shotgun. Bobby Brown, Mark Perry, Ron Elwell, and Clarence and Todd Jones. But other than Bobby, none of those 5 had ever been at the crime scene alone and couldn't have taken the gun without someone else seeing that they had done so.
This list is not quite complete, though, because in addition to those 5 known witnesses, there was that 6th witness, too. We just don't know his name.
But Bobby does say he pointed the gun at someone.
He does. And we kept thinking, it's gotta be Snow. It's gotta be somebody. It also means, when he said that, Bobby pointed the gun at somebody...
Right away.
Right away.
Before he saw anyone else.
Before he saw anyone else.
When I started working on this case, I hadn't thought of this man that Bobby pointed the gun at as a new witness at all. I'd assumed he was someone we already knew about who had been at or near the crime scene. Bobby must have pointed the gun at one of them, and they just never mentioned it in any witness statement they ever gave. So we just had to figure out which witness it was. We knew it couldn't be Mark Perry. Bobby would have recognized him, obviously. And Ron Elwell never even saw Bobby that entire night, so it can't be him either. Ron Elwell also doesn't think it could have been Clarence or Todd Jones that Bobby encountered.
Did Clarence mention the boy pointing a gun at him?
Boy, if he did, I don't remember that.
Clarence Jones is much older than the person that Bobby described pointing the gun at. His son Todd has blonde hair and glasses, so could be a closer fit for Bobby's description, but both Clarence and Todd came much later in the evening. They were out there way too late to have been the person that Bobby ran into just as he was leaving the crime scene. With those 5 witnesses ruled out as being the man Bobby pointed the gun at, we started to work our way down the list of all the other witnesses known to be anywhere near the crime scene that night.
Was the kid, was he pointing the gun at anyone?
No, but you could tell he was really distraught. And...
Yeah, he was upset, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Did he point a gun at you?
No, okay. No.
Every known witness at the game area denied being the man that Bobby pointed a gun at.
The other thing Bobby said is that he pointed this gun at someone, and he never saw that person again that entire night. He said they just disappeared. I don't know what happened to them. I never saw them again.
It was while trying to puzzle out who Bobby had pointed the gun at that I finally realized what was not adding up about the reports of who was at the crime scene that night. Because there were only 5 witnesses who were ever seen there, but there are 7 witnesses who claim to have been there.
Five days after the murders, investigators received a call from an unnamed source. The source said he worked with a guy named Jack Badger, who had been telling all his co-workers about how he'd been at the crime scene at the Fulton game area. Badger claimed to have heard a shot, followed by a yell for help, and then when he'd gone over to see what happened, he found two people standing next to a dead body that was lying face down on the forest floor. There was a second body nearby too, but this one, Badger said, had been leaning up against a tree. When the two people standing by the first body noticed Jack Badger standing there, they'd fled across a field, hopped into a car, and driven away. That's when Badger had walked over and seen a billfold lying on the ground near one of the bodies. Its contents had been strewn about. Following the tip from Badger's co-worker, Detective Wiersema went out to interview him. Badger denied the report, though. "I never said that I saw bodies or any such thing," Badger told him. "I just heard about the murders while out at my friend Troy Jones' house. We'd stopped by to pick up some clothing for Troy, and Troy's mom told us that some guys had been shot in the woods and that Troy's dad, Clarence, had gone out looking for Ron Elwell." Jack Badger said that he and Troy had started back into the woods to look for Clarence, but Clarence had returned home just as they were leaving. So in the end, Badger told the detective he and Troy had never actually gotten anywhere near the bodies. He'd never seen them himself, he said.
A couple weeks later, a second tip was called in about Jack Badger. This one came in from Jim Bennett's father, who had learned that, on the night of the murders, Jack Badger had borrowed his girlfriend's Z24, which is basically a Chevy Cavalier. It was very similar to the car that was seen in the ditch. Because of that, detectives went and interviewed Jack Badger's girlfriend, who we're going to call Tina. In 1990, Tina had been a bartender over at the Thunderhog, the local bar in Leonidas.
Did you know a guy named Jack Badger?
Yes.
Okay, how'd you know him?
I was dating him, and I remember he took my car, him and his other friend, I don't even know what
Troy?
That. Troy. Yep, took my car, and then they come back to the bar.
Tina asked that we not use her real name. Not because of anything having to do with the murders, she would just rather not have it known that she had once dated Jack Badger. On November 17th, 1990, Jack Badger had told Tina that he and his friend Troy Jones were going out deer hunting. Or maybe he told her that they were setting up a deer blind. She's not sure which now.
And do they deer hunt a lot?
I don't know. I only dated him for like a week.
That night, while bartending at the Thunderhog, Jack Badger had called Tina. "I'm at the office bar in Athens," he told her. "I need you to pick me up." "I can't pick you up," Tina told him. "I'm working." But Jack Badger was insistent. So eventually, Tina asked her friend Kathy to go pick him up.
So she was there that night as well, I guess.
I'm thinking she was.
Yeah.
She probably knew more about it than me, because she knew Jack pretty well. As a matter of fact, she was the one that set me and Jack up, I believe.
After getting Jack from the bar in Athens, Kathy had taken him back to the Thunderhog to see Tina.
And they were all in shock. They said they just found the body and...
They just, like, found the body?
That's what they were walking to the woods, going deer hunting or something, and they found the body up against the tree. That's all they told me.
So they seemed shook up, though?
Oh, they very.
Like, they seemed, like, emotional and...
Yes. Jack did. I don't think Troy was with them. I think it was just Jack.
After getting to the Thunderhog, Jack Badger had begged to borrow Tina's car, and eventually she'd agreed. Though, Jack ended up being gone with it for much longer than Tina had expected.
Seems to me like he was supposed to be back with my car like at 7, and it took him, he didn't get there till like closing time.
So you were annoyed or nervous or?
Wondering where my car was at. And I'm thinking because they found the bodies, they had to wait for the police to get, I don't know.
Tina's Z24 resembled the ditch car, but the good news is we can be pretty confident it was not the ditch car. It did not have a broken taillight like the ditch car had, and Badger does not at all resemble the Ditchman composite. Most importantly, though, Jack Badger had not borrowed Tina's car until early in the evening, after the murders had taken place. So Jack Badger is not the Ditchman. Though there was another car sighting that night near the game area that may be relevant here. A witness who had been driving through Fulton at about 6:30 or so had seen police cars blocking the roads into the game area. And as he passed by, he saw a car that looked very similar to Tina's that had been pulled off into a field, just behind where the roads into the game area had been blocked off by the police. Tina doesn't know where Jack Badger took her car that night, and until we spoke to her, she had not been aware that neither Jack Badger nor Troy Jones had ever spoken to police on the night of the murders. Nor was she aware that when Badger was interviewed a few days later, he had denied that he'd ever seen any bodies at the game area. But Tina felt certain that he hadn't been lying when he told her he'd seen the bodies.
I was curious if you'd say, like, he seemed like he was putting it on, or if he was...
See, I don't think he was. From what I saw, because I was, like, in shock. Like, yeah, I don't think he was. And that's what scared me, and that's what I'm like, oh, God.
So nothing at the time made you doubt the story?
Because he was wigged out. He was crying, and he was bawling.
Tina said she'd only seen Badger once or twice more after that night at the Thunder Hog. His behavior had been erratic and concerning, and she'd broken things off. So there was not that much more about Badger that she could tell us.
You ought to talk to Kathy.
Swinehart?
Yeah, yeah. From what I recall, she was pretty good friends with him.
Kathy had driven Jack Badger from the office bar to the Thunder Hog that night, and we were hoping that maybe he'd told her more about what had happened out at the game area during the car ride over. Our conversation with Kathy had been very brief, though. She said she remembered Jack Badger vaguely, and remembered the Fulton game area murders vaguely, but that was about it. Wish I could help you, she told us, but it's been too damn long. I don't remember anything.
She's lying, 100%.
The next time that Jack Badger's name came up in this case was in 2000, when the cold case team went back to Tina and interviewed her again. She told them the same thing she told the original detectives back in 1990. But then she added something else. 4 months ago, I ran into Jack Badger's friend Troy Jones, Tina told the cold case team, and I asked him, hey, weren't you with Badger when you found those dead guys in the woods? Troy said that he was, and that one of the men had been up against a tree, and there'd been a shotgun like he'd been hunting, and the other guy had looked like he'd been running away when he was shot. It'd been a horrible sight, Troy told her.
In November of 2001, one of the detectives on the cold case team must have also come to the realization that this case had a problem. And that problem was Jack Badger and Troy Jones. By that point, though, the cold case team was just a month away from arresting Jeff Titus. Their investigation had already been winding down, but the cold case team must have decided this problem was too big to ignore completely. We don't know what caused the cold case team to realize there was a problem here. That part isn't recorded. What we do know is that two cold case detectives went to interview Clarence Jones, and they'd had a very specific question they needed to ask him.
I interviewed Clarence Jones in reference to his recollections of the homicides on November 17, 1990. I specifically wanted to know if he remembered Jack Badger or his son Troy Jones being back at the crime scene.
Clarence Jones gave the cold case team the same answer he had given every other time that he'd been interviewed in this case.
We asked Clarence Jones about the information we were getting and that Troy Jones and Jack Badger were two individuals who first found the bodies of the hunters. According to Clarence, that was completely not true and could not have been possible, since neither Badger nor Troy Jones were anywhere in the area.
In the days following the interview with Clarence Jones, the cold case detectives also interviewed Troy's brother Todd, his mother Pat, and his neighbor Ron Elwell. They asked each of them the same question they asked Clarence.
Todd Jones states that he remembers his mother being at home and he and his father Clarence had been summoned to the state game area because someone had been shot. Todd Jones only remembers seeing his mother at home. He does not remember seeing his brother Troy or Jack Badger.
Pat Jones, when asked whether or not she saw her son Troy Jones or Jack Badger that day, indicates she did not see Jack Badger at her house and her son Troy lives at the residence, so she's sure she saw him on that day, but she did not remember when.
Ron Elwell does not recall Troy Jones or Jack Badger being at the scene on November 17, 1990. I asked Elwell if he remembers seeing either of those two individuals on that day. Elwell said that he did not remember seeing them.
The cold case team also interviewed Jack Badger and Troy Jones and asked them the same question that they asked Troy's family and neighbor. Both Jack and Troy gave the cold case team the same answer. Yes, they said. They had been back there at the crime scene at the same time as everyone else.
This just doesn't make sense.
He's there for half an hour?
And no one remembers that he's there for half an hour?
Jacinta and I called Kevin to explain why we'd suddenly become so interested in Troy and Badger. Two witnesses who, up until that point, we had all assumed were insignificant figures in the case.
And the other thing is, I don't know if I told you, Troy Jones, he's the one who lives right there on the corner at the Fulton game area. His dad was there. We know that for a fact. His brother was there and the neighbor was there. Those three people do not report seeing Troy or Badger there.
They're very adamant they never saw him.
And the mother also says, no, I never saw Troy.
They would have had to have seen the bodies before everybody else got there, then. It's the only possible scenario.
When Jacinda and I spoke to Troy's brother, Todd, we had told him about what his brother had said about being there at the crime scene. And Todd claimed that he'd never heard before that his brother said he was there. It just didn't make sense, Todd said. Troy couldn't have been there when we were there.
He didn't see his brother. He actually came to this conclusion on his own. That would have meant they had to get there before we did.
The cold case team must have come to the same realization. That's why they'd gone out and conducted a flurry of interviews that were all aimed at trying to resolve this question of why Jack Badger and Troy Jones said that they were at the crime scene, when everyone else who was there says they weren't. But then it seems like the cold case team just gave up on this line of investigation. They simply dropped the issue and moved on to arresting Jeff Titus.
What doesn't make sense, okay? You're saying, like, oh, we're close to trying to fix it. But he doesn't fix it.
You can't. There's no way to fix it. It's a problem.
The only way to fix it is if someone says, yeah, we saw them.
But they're not willing to do that.
Willing to bend.
In fact, further investigation into this issue seems like it was just making the cold case team's problem worse. One witness he spoke to was a friend of Troy's that the cold case team had also tracked down. And Troy's friend told us that Troy had once told him about how he'd been there at the crime scene that night. In the course of this conversation, Troy had made a curious comment. He'd mentioned how, after being back there, he'd been concerned that he and Jack Badger had left footprints at the scene. I asked Troy's friend why Troy and Jack had even been back there in the first place. I think they just wanted to see a dead body, he told me. The only two people who can really answer this question about what's going on with Troy Jones and Jack Badger is Troy Jones and Jack Badger themselves. Jacinda and I decided to try speaking to Jack Badger first, but when we stopped by his place, he hadn't been home. Or at least, that's what the woman who answered the door told us when we explained why we were there. It was a day or two after that when Jacinda and I went to speak to Troy Jones. We had just knocked on his front door when we heard the sound of a truck starting up, and looked over to see that Troy had apparently gone out the side door to the garage and was trying to drive away. Unfortunately for him, Jacinda had accidentally parked our car in a way that meant he was partially blocked from getting out, and it slowed his exit down just enough for us to walk over there and start talking to him. We had started to introduce ourselves, but Troy told us he already knew who we were. Jack Badger had told him all about it. And after our interview with Troy, Jacinda and I had called Kevin to update him on how it had gone.
Basically, so Jack Badger, when we were at his house, he freaked out. He went to his ex-friend Troy's house and leaves a note and says, you gotta come talk to me. So Troy drives out to talk to him and he's freaking out. And Troy says he told him, like, you brought this on yourself. You've been running your mouth.
And Troy tells him, you have nothing to worry about. You were with me and Tim LaPlante that day, remember?
Tim was another friend of Troy's, and Troy told us that when he'd gotten that note from Jack and driven over to see him, he told Jack just to remember that he didn't do nothing, and that the three of them had been together. It was you, me, and Tim LaPlante.
He even, like, it was like a dramatic one, two, three of us were together.
Oh my god, he did do that. Like, he put his hands out and counted.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I don't care who you were that morning, because by the time you got here, Tim was long gone.
Like, I'm like, why is Tim even part of the story?
Yeah, one, two, three.
Tim LaPlante, for his part, no longer recalls anything about this day. When we'd asked him if Badger and Troy Jones had been at his house that day, he told us that if they said they'd been there, then yeah, they probably were, but he didn't recall anything about it. As for what had actually happened that night at the game area, Troy told us more or less the same thing he told the cold case team 20 years ago. He and Jack had gotten to his house that evening, and his mom had said that someone was shot in the game area, and that his father, Clarence, had gone out to check on Ron Elwell. His mom had asked if he and Jack could go out and look for them, so they had, and gotten back to the crime scene and waited there for approximately half an hour. When I told Troy that neither his mom, nor his dad, nor Ron Elwell had recalled seeing either him or Badger out there, Troy seemed unfazed. I know they saw me there, he said. We were all in a little group looking at one another. I was there, so was Jack. Then Troy told us what had happened when he and Badger first made it back to the crime scene.
He says he went back in the woods, and the first person he sees is Bobby Brown pointing a gun at him. But the timing is off. Bobby would have been gone by then.
That was like one of the first things that happened. way before even Elwell's there or Clarence Jones. There's no plausible scenario where these guys could have seen Bobby Brown at the crime scene like he's describing. Not and have it not be shady.
But what do they say? They say that they went back there and saw the bodies and saw Bobby Brown. That's basically their story?
Well, what he said at first, he says that the kids pointed the gun at him, and he says, whoa, we heard the shouts for help and went out here.
Troy said that the kid, Bobby, had pointed a gun at his face and accused him of committing the murders. Troy told us that he said to the kid, no, dude, we just heard somebody yell for help, and I'm assuming that was you.
I swear, when he was talking to Bobby, he was like saying, we heard you yelling help.
Yeah, no, he did say that. He messed that up.
Troy must have realized his error as well, or maybe he saw the surprise on my face, because I'd asked him, wait, you heard somebody yell for help? And he'd quickly corrected himself. No, my mom and dad heard the yells for help. I didn't hear it. I wasn't at home.
By the time he would have gotten home, his mom had said, your dad went down there. Like, Bobby's not yelling anymore at that point.
No.
Bobby's in whoever's house making his phone call, trying to reach his mother.
Yeah.
Like, the timing is off.
The timing is way off.
To have run into Bobby.
There's just no way his story's true.
The only way his story is true is if he was first there. He was there before anyone else.
I asked Troy what the crime scene had looked like when he'd been back there, and he described how the larger body, that of Doug Estes, had been laid out face down. I think he was running away, Troy told us, but the guy from Leonidas, he was leaned up against a tree sitting, like he was in a sitting position.
Against the tree? Was he someone trying to help, and they put him against a tree?
Because also, like, how do you get shot through the back if your back is leaning against a tree?
He didn't die instantly.
There is talk about someone crawling. So the police, somebody leaks that one of them crawled. Everyone assumes it's Doug because of the position of his head under
but
the tree.
It is not Doug.
It's actually Jim Bennett.
Bennett's body had fallen between two trees. But around the base of one of those trees, there had been bloodstains and scuff marks in the leaves, as if someone had been dragged or maybe crawled. Descendant and I began to wonder if maybe Bennett hadn't fallen between those two trees after he was shot. Maybe he'd staggered for a moment. Maybe he'd leaned back against the tree trunk before he died. It's the only explanation I can think of, anyway, for how Troy Jones and Jack Badger could have possibly seen what they say they saw. Sometime after speaking to Troy Jones, Jacinda and I went to interview the group of young hunters from Parchment, the ones who told us that when they arrived at the parking area off of X Avenue, there had been two men already there, one of whom was wearing Stephen King glasses. And that man, the one we're calling Stephen King for short, had kept trying to get them to come back to see these two bodies in the woods. I asked one of the hunters, Bill Palmateer, about what else Stephen King had said to them when they were standing there in the parking area.
Did he describe the scene to you? Did he tell you, like, how the hunters were shot, what they looked like?
Yeah.
What did he say?
He said that one of them leaned up against a tree and he was shot in the chest. Another one was laid over his belly over a log, and all of the contents of his wallet was on the ground. That's what he said. And he said there was no guns back there, nothing.
So you feel pretty sure about the tree? One's against the tree.
He said he was sitting against the tree with his legs crossed, his head down, like he never even seen it coming, and we said.
Bill's friend, Phil Dooley, had been the first in the group to arrive at the parking area off of X Avenue, so he was the first to encounter Stephen King. I asked Phil the same question I'd asked to his friend.
I heard that they both took one to the chest, you know, like one, like sitting, like still sitting, and one looked like maybe had been, like, you know, standing, you know, like walking up to the one that, and I don't know.
Sitting.
Like one was sitting against a tree, shot.
Neither of the hunters from Parchment ever saw the crime scene for themselves. Their descriptions are based on what they remember Stephen King telling them. They had never gotten Stephen King's name, and both he and his friend were gone before police arrived. But the hunters from Parchment recalled a few details about Stephen King that might hint at who he could have been.
And you're definitely sure.
I thought he lived in the area.
Why do you say that?
Because, it seemed like he said he didn't travel far to get there, if I remember.
Phil Dooley told me that when he'd pulled up at the parking area, Stephen King and his friend had been hanging out next to the ambulance, even though they weren't wearing any sort of clothes that would mark them as first responders or as ambulance employees.
And he seemed kind of cozy with the ambulance, it seems like.
Oh, yeah, he leaned right up against it.
This affinity between Stephen King and the ambulance seems potentially relevant. There were two ambulance attendants who arrived at the crime scene that night. One of them had been a guy named Bobby Burgett, who both Troy and Jack Badger had gone to high school with. In fact, in Jack Badger's very first statement, he'd mentioned to Detective Racema that he knew Bobby Burgett and seen him pull up in an ambulance. And when Jacinda and I spoke to Troy Jones, he had repeatedly brought up Bobby Burgett to us as well, though he'd done so in a strangely derogatory way. In our conversation, Troy Jones called Bobby Burgett an idiot or a fucking idiot at least 4 or 5 times, and he couldn't really explain why when I'd asked him either. He just said that he'd grown up knowing Bobby Burgett, and that's how he knew he was an idiot. Still, maybe back in 1990, Troy and Bobby Burgett had been on friendlier terms. And maybe that's why Stephen King had been seen lounging against the ambulance in the game area. There's another detail, too, that Billy had remembered about what Stephen King said that could be relevant here.
He just said, I found these bodies. Come check it out.
Did he say, I found them?
Yeah. He said, I found these bodies. Come check it out.
That's the same thing Tina remembered Jack Badger saying to her that night at the Thunderhog. He told her that he and Troy had found the bodies.
Why is Troy, assuming this person is Troy, we don't know for sure, but assuming this person is, why is he sticking around? Like, why is he...
I think to get footprints back there.
To get footprints back there?
I think
there?
He's afraid... Wade Harnish said that Troy was afraid of the footprints.
Right.
So I think he stays to get people to go back there and, like, contaminate the scene, not knowing the cops are never going to look at the footprints in the first place.
And why not come clean then and say, yeah, we found the bodies? And
because if you're them, and they probably can't see themselves being able to get out of a scenario of a potential murder rap.
Yeah.
Right. Like they don't strike me as the type that the cops are just going to believe when they say we had nothing to do with this.
Both Troy Jones and Stephen King, whoever he is, describe the crime scene in similar terms. And there's one detail in their description that makes me think that they didn't have anything to do with this. They said that Jim Bennett had been shot while sitting or perhaps sleeping with his back against a tree, and that it seemed as if someone had snuck up on him and shot him in the chest.
One sitting against a tree with his arms down, his legs were crossed, like he never even seen it coming. The person just walked up to him and shot him while he was sleeping.
Bobby Round says, though, it was clear to him when he found the crime scene that that's not what had happened.
You could tell he was not shot in the chest.
If he's sitting against a tree, it can't.
Right.
If he really thinks the guy shot in the chest, he doesn't know he shot in the back.
It looked like, yeah, his chest was blown out.
Well, but can you tell exit from entry wound?
No, because I rolled him over.
But if you just see the front, you might think that's the entrance wound spread out.
You wouldn't be able to tell.
Troy Jones had to have been one of the first people at the crime scene because, by his own admission, he was the man Bobby encountered as he left the crime scene in search of help.
Like, you feel certain there's only one guy you ever pointed a gun at that day.
Yeah.
We spoke to Troy. He denied that he'd been there before his father Clarence or Ron Elwell had been. And he denied that he and Jack Badger ever had anything to hide about their presence at the crime scene. They just hadn't been interested in giving statements to the police, he said. That's why they'd left before the police could arrive. It had nothing to do with me and Jack, Troy said, because I know where we were that whole afternoon. As for Jack Badger, I never was able to interview him. The one time I spoke to him directly had been very brief, and the only thing he would tell me was, that was all a very long time ago and I don't want to talk about it. But Jack's prior statements in the case file make it clear that there is something that he and Troy are not being truthful about.
Badger and Troy were up to something.
This is the worst, because, like, I'm convinced they're hiding something. Like, utterly convinced, but I cannot say what it is.
Right.
But something is not
hiding
up.
And they could be hiding something completely different.
I know.
Like, they could have been back there burying cocaine.
They were poaching a deer, and they're like, oh my gosh, the DNR is going to come for us.
Whatever they were up to, it was not something they wanted people to know about.
One thought I kept going back to, though, is how, in a statement to the cold case team, Jack Badger described how apprehensive and nervous he'd been, how tense things had felt there at the crime scene. There'd been a man there who was very upset and very armed, and for all Badger knew, this was the guy who just blasted two hunters away. And Troy told us that both he and Jack had been unarmed when they were there in the woods. What if, in a moment of panic, Jack Badger had seen a shotgun lying there in the woods and he'd grabbed it to use for his own protection? Just in case the murderer was still out there in the woods, lurking behind a tree somewhere. Although, based on the first report on Badger in the case file, the one about how he told people at work that he came across two people standing over a body, who then fled the scene when they saw him, there's another possibility here that can't be entirely ruled out.
The other thing is based on what you guys had told me and what I think is possible, if they were sitting in that blind near there, they saw who did it.
Yeah.
And they know who did it, or they know... Or they just know it was someone, and they don't want any part of that. But imagine if they know who did it. Imagine if it's somebody from around there, and they're just kind of like, "Fuck this! Like, we don't want this guy coming after us."
After we talked to Troy, Jacinda and I had gone back to see Bobby Brown again. We'd wanted to find out from him if there was any possible way that what Troy Jones had described could be reconciled with the crime scene that Bobby had encountered.
James Bennett was face down.
I just think that the way he said this guy said it. I really think he saw the body of Jim against a tree.
He was there before me then.
Yeah.
If he was saying that, then he's probably the one that moved him.
It was Bobby who came up with a theory that may best explain the evidence in this case. If somebody found the bodies before me, Bobby told us, but they never came forward to tell the police about it, then they probably pocket-checked the victims. People can be heartless like that, he said. Jacinda and I had considered and rejected far more elaborate scenarios, but Bobby's theory offered a simple explanation for something that Jacinda and I had been struggling to understand. If Jack Badger and Troy Jones really had seen Jim Bennett sitting against a tree, as both have repeatedly claimed, then how come Bennett was lying face down when Bobby found him?
But if you're sitting against a tree, how do you get the wallet out?
Yeah, if you're sitting on it.
Yeah.
We know from the bloodstains that were found in Jim Bennett's pockets that his wallet was removed after his death. But if Jim Bennett really had died sitting against a tree, then no one could have removed his wallet without first moving him. Later on, I interview Bobby Brown again, this time about Rich Vendeville. That's the same guy that Jeff Titus met in prison. The one who had an absurd amount of knowledge about Titus's case, and who claimed to have been an informant for cold case detective Workema. Turns out that Rich Vendeville had been in jail with Bobby Brown too, and just like with Jeff Titus, Vendeville had tried to make friends with Bobby. Bobby told me that Rich Vendeville was the reason that, when he'd heard about someone else claiming to have found the bodies, he'd suggested that they might have robbed Doug and Jim. Because while he and Vendeville had been in jail together, Vendeville had told Bobby a story about how he'd once been walking out in the woods when he came across a man who'd committed suicide. So, Vendeville said, he'd robbed the body and then kept on walking. And something like that could have happened here, too.
Because it was opening season in this crowded place. Everyone's like, oh, it's so crowded. It hadn't occurred to me before, but, like, it is weird that no one else came through in that half hour.
Right, it is really weird. It's such a small area.
Yes, there had been plenty of time for Jack Badger and Troy Jones to have wandered across the crime scene first, but there was plenty of time for lots of others to have done so as well. And maybe one of them was someone like Rich Vendeville. Someone who, when he saw the bodies, had robbed them, and then kept on walking. Bobby's theory about why someone would have wanted to hide the fact they found the bodies also brought to mind another report from the case file. It was a page of notes written by Detective Mike Brown just a few months into the cold case team's investigation. It read,
Skeeter Cerny called and wanted me to call him, which I did. He told me that he had a party and talked to someone who doesn't want to talk to the police. He told Skeeter there was guys hunting in Fulton at the time of the homicide. He said one of them took the billfolds out of one of the victim's pockets, looked in it, and threw it back down.
The men that Skeeter had named are listed at the bottom of the note.
Jack Allen Badger. Troy. Father owns a junkyard. All are from Athens.
Do you know someone named Troy Jones?
Troy Jones?
Yeah.
No.
Or no. Jack Badger?
Jack Badger? Names don't ring a bell at all.
You had one statement in there I was wondering about, where you told them about those names.
I did?
Mm-hmm.
Me?
Yeah.
I never said, I don't even know them. I don't even ever heard of them names.
But Jack, so you don't know Badger? These people.
Jack Badger?
Huh. I don't have a clue what the hell they're talking about. Where are these guys from? Is it from...
Athens.
From Athens. I don't know anyone in Athens.
Skeeter had been unable to shed any light on the origins of this report, so I was hoping Detective Mike Brown, who had written the page of notes, might remember more.
Do you remember the name Jack Badger?
Seems like I do, yeah.
What do you remember about him?
Well, you remind me about.
He was a witness, apparently. Him and his friend, Troy Jones.
Well, that name sounds familiar, but...
I think you interviewed them.
Could be, it could be. Because Jack Badger rings a bell, yeah.
But you don't recall what you were talking to them about?
No, well, I'm 80 years old. Can't recall yesterday.
I don't know about that. You seem to recall quite a bit.
Although no one on the cold case team will acknowledge it now, it's clear that at least for a time, they had in fact been intensely interested in Jack Badger and Troy Jones. Numerous interviews have been conducted in a failed attempt to explain their presence at the crime scene. Other investigation into the pair had been done as well. For instance, in the Kalamazoo County case file, there is what appears to be, bizarrely, a collection of discarded documents from Jack Badger's residence. Things like his girlfriend's dental bills, an old pay stub, a fast food receipt, empty envelopes, and stray handwritten notes. It's unclear what investigative purpose those materials had, but on the same day that Clarence Jones had been interviewed in November 2001, and Clarence had denied seeing his son Troy or Jack Badger anywhere near the crime scene, the cold case team decided to get the crime lab involved in the matter. In a report noting that both Jeff Titus and Bobby Brown had been excluded as matches for any prints found at the crime scene, a detective wrote, quote, "At the time this laboratory report was made, Lieutenant Pearson of the Michigan State Police indicates there does remain latent fingerprints and a palm print of value for comparison in this case. Therefore, the latent prints of Jack Badger and Troy Jones need to be submitted for comparison." 5 days later, the cold case team sent in a request to the crime lab to compare the prints of Troy and Jack with the latent prints found on the materials from Jim Bennett's wallet. Both Troy and Jack were listed as suspects in the request. It's not clear what happened to it after that. If the crime lab ever did carry out the requested latent print comparison, the results aren't recorded in either the crime lab's file or in Kalamazoo County's file.
It wasn't just the detectives in the cold case team either who were worried about Troy Jones and Jack Badger. The prosecution was worried about them too. At trial, Prosecutor Scott Brower called both Ron Elwell and Todd Jones to the witness stand. This was a somewhat curious choice for him to make, particularly in calling Todd Jones, as Todd had been at the crime scene for only seconds before he'd turned and left again. He seemingly had no evidence relevant to Titus' guilt that he could offer. The prosecutor's questions for Ron Elwell and Todd Jones had been brief, though, and almost exclusively directed at a single topic. Had they seen either Troy Jones or Jack Badger anywhere near the crime scene that night? Both Elwell and Todd Jones confirmed that they had not. Which means the prosecutor had known that Jack Badger and Troy Jones were a problem for him. A big enough problem that he needed to try to defuse it before it blew up his entire case. Prosecutor Brower needn't have bothered, though. Jeff Titus's attorneys had never noticed that the problem existed in the first place.
After I'd gotten back from my first trip to Kalamazoo, I'd been looking more into Jack Badger's background when I came across an obituary for his father, Jack Badger Sr. He had died 2 years before the murders in 1988. And while skimming through the obituary, there was a line in it that jumped out at me. It said, "Jack Badger Sr. was employed as a boiler operator for the past 13 years at the VA Medical Center. Jack Badger's father had worked at the VA's power plant. He had worked with Big Jack Warren."
Jack Badger.
I know. I can't believe I didn't even look for this sooner. It just seems so ludicrous that they could possibly be connected.
He does. Oh my God. Big Jack does know people from Athens.
He knows this one person because, so like, when Jack talked to us, he was like, "Yeah, I used to be a plumber, but then I worked in the power plant."
Oh my God. It seems ludicrous, but it's the connection. It has to be.
Big Jack Warren and Jack Badger Jr. were from two different generations and two different sides of the county. I had assumed, wrongly, that there was no connection between them. But there was a connection. And Jacinda and I realized that we needed to talk to Big Jack Warren again and ask him some questions we hadn't known to ask the first time we met with him.
Do you know someone named Jack Badger?
Jack Badger?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure do. I was with him the night he died. And Jack Jr., I don't know where he lives now, but he lived down by Athens.
Jack Badger Sr. had been a close friend of Big Jack Warren's. They had worked together at the VA for many years and had hunted together down at Badger Sr.'s farm down in Athens. But Big Jack and his daughter Kelly told me that they didn't know much about Jack Badger Sr.'s son.
Jack kind of Jr. hangs with a rough crowd.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be somebody we'd associate with.
So you didn't stay in touch with him, you don't think, or?
When's the last time you talked to Jack Jr.? At the funeral?
Basically about it.
Did you ever talk to Jack Jr. about this case?
No. He was in a unsettled period of time in his life. He got in trouble like it. In Battle Creek, there's a strip of several bars, and he'd go there and drink and maybe get in trouble to where it would come to fist fight. And one time the way he got away was to hide in the dumpster behind the building.
Did it work?
Yeah.
Did you ever hear that Jack Badger Jr. may have been involved in this case?
No. I never heard of Jack Badger's name being used. Oh, and I definitely would have perked up, you know, hearing the name because I thought so much of his dad.
Right.
But if he was to tell me that he possibly knows somebody...
from the bars.
Yeah, I'd believe that.
I heard that later when I used to shoot pool with my sister and her husband, that...
See, I always thought that this
that
was...
that he was friends with one of those guys.
Jacinda and I left our second interview with the Warrens with no firm answers and more questions than ever.
I was hoping for a big revelation.
Me too. Nothing's ever easy, though.
Big Jack says he never heard anything directly from Jack Badger Jr. about the murders, and I don't have anything that would contradict that. But I still wonder if Big Jack could have heard something about Jack Badger Jr. from someone else.
Is there anyone else at the power plant who was close to Jack Badger? Or that Junior might have been close to?
No, from that time period, I'm the only one still alive.
Even if Big Jack didn't have direct knowledge about Jack Badger's ties to this case, there are others who worked at the power plant who might have known more. The problem is, they're no longer around to confirm it, one way or the other. But that story Jeff says he was told about how someone from Athens took the gun away and then panicked and returned it to the crime scene, yeah, it sounded pretty far-fetched at first. And the prosecutor used it at Jeff's trial to show what a liar he was. But after learning about Jack Badger and his father's close friendships with the VA, Jeff's story no longer sounded far-fetched to me. It just sounded like he'd heard some workplace gossip about a former colleague's son. And there's a question that no one's ever asked Jack Badger that I think could be important here. On the night of the murders, why had he been so desperate to borrow his girlfriend's car? Where exactly was it that he'd needed to go? And was it Tina's car that a witness had seen that night, pulled off deep into a field off of X Avenue, as if someone had been trying to find a way past the police barricades and back into the Fulton Game area? From the beginning, there was an assumption in this case that whoever killed Doug Estes and Jim Bennett is the same person who went through Jim's wallet and moved Doug's shotgun. This assumption went unquestioned and even shaped the direction of investigations outside of Michigan.
If there was any kind of contact between the shooter and one of the victims, that would not be Dylan. He would never seek somebody's wallet. Then there was the report of the shotgun missing. Logic would tell you if it was Dylan, you know, and after he shot, he would be on his way out of there so quick. He would not have time to, you know, certainly go through personal belongings, but to grab somebody's shotgun. So if that activity did in fact happen, I can tell you that's not Tom Dillon.
This same logic was used to rule out possible suspects in Michigan as well. In fact, for the cold case team, it was enough to eliminate every single suspect but one, Jeff Titus. Only Jeff Titus, they said, could have had the motive to take the shotgun from the crime scene after committing the murders.
Do you think Titus will ever walk out of prison?
No, he won't. He's exhausted his appeals. He got life in prison. It's first-degree murder. And he killed two people by shooting them in the back. He's exactly where he deserves to be, and he will die there.
Shortly after Jeff Titus's conviction, his friend Stan Driscoll wrote a letter to him. Stan had been attempting, in his own verbose way, to offer Jeff a glimmer of hope about the future.
Last night, I lay abed and contemplated your case. The saga of Fulton Woods unfolded to me as a five-act Greek tragedy. Act one is short, comprising a single actor, identified neither to audience nor cast members. Act one culminates in violent murder. Act two, extending over the subsequent decade, unfolds as a collage of your loosely related acts and foolish public statements, inexorably motivated by the plethora of conflicting forces that drive you. Events of Act 2 become the grist of multiple self-serving interpretations during Acts 3 and 4. Act 3 introduces the villains in the form of the cold case team. While the villains present themselves to the audience as the defender of quote-unquote truth and justice, they are in actuality driven by imperatives of a perfect conviction record, which leads to presumed individual rewards. To this end, the villains scavenge the collage of Act 2, but reveal only those components supportive of their self-serving goals. Appearing in Act 4, quote-unquote, the judge, the attorneys, and the jury, a thoughtful audience will perceive that the rules enforced by the judge permit only tantalizing glimpses of Acts 2 and 3, and thus disallows objective contemplation of Act 1. Act 4 ends with the villain's attorney shamelessly fabricating an emotion-laden scenario anchored in fantasy. The protagonist's attorney counters this fantasy with a vacuous summation that would shame a high school debating society. Act 5 is yet to be written.
Act 5 has been the longest and slowest act so far in this Greek tragedy.
It's just so slow. I mean, I'm my 19th year. Pretty soon, it's all 19 and a half years.
You sound less hopeful than you have in the past.
Every time I get my hope built up, it gets let down, and I'm still here. I don't get no breaks. I mean, I didn't do it, and every time I turn around, I get denied. All these judges deny, deny, deny.
Jeff Titus's attorneys at the University of Michigan Innocence Clinic hope to bring Jeff Titus's case before the courts again, though. And to try, once again, to have the courts finally confront the fact that this conviction is, at best, based on smoke and mirrors. And at worst, is based on the cold case team's belief that Jeff Titus just looks guilty. Which means, although this is our last regularly scheduled episode in our series on Jeff Titus, it will not be our final episode on Jeff's case. Because this case isn't over yet. Act 5 is still being written. Thanks for listening to Season 5 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. A huge special thanks for this season goes out to Kevin Fitzpatrick, Jacinda Davis, and the others at Red Marble Media. Without them, this season would not have been possible. There's still one more addendum to go, though, so send us your questions about the season for our discussion this Thursday and our final addendum on Jeff's case. Amethyl Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partisan Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. Music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logis, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell.
And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online and on all social media. Our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.